This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, When You Say Nothing at All, sparkling dialogue in speculative fiction.
This week, Jules has gone again for lyrics
in
the title.
And I've probably freaked Madeleine out because I actually gave her, well, it's not homework if you give it to somebody before the actual, I gave her work to do before this one.
I know, I've never had to actually work for, okay, that's a lie, you know, I do a little bit of research and stuff like that on the topic and stuff like that, but I was given an exercise to do. Mrs. Ironside, or rather Miss Ironside.
I was going to say, when did I get married? I missed that.
Congratulations, Jules. Yeah, so I got given a writing exercise and I have no idea what's happening. So I'm as much in the dark right now as our listeners are.
Yeah, so we'll do that a little bit later and I will fully explain everything at that time.
How very Hercule Poirot of you.
Exactly, yeah. My big reveal. It was the butler. It's always the butler.
It's always the butler. So I guess the best place to start this whole conversation is to first of all introduce what dialogue is for anyone who may be uncertain and how we feel about it.
Yeah, definitely. And it's one of those things that when people start writing, I think they believe that writing dialogue is the easy part and then writing narrative around it, and including voice and description, is actually the harder part. And actually writing dialogue, writing incisive dialogue that moves the plot along, is probably one of the most difficult things you can learn to do.
Yes, it is. So just in case there's anyone who has no idea about the terminology at all, dialogue is the spoken bit in a story or in a script or something along those lines. So dialogue is the part where people are speaking, the conversation. And I'm with you on this, Jules. Dialogue is incredibly interesting, both to write and to read. I don't know about you, but when I was younger, one thing I used to do was sort of skip sections just so that I could get to the dialogue.
You're talking to the wrong person.
Yeah, no, okay, no, as in, like, if there was a long description, I'd just go, dialogue, and I just get drawn to the dialogue. I really, really love dialogue. And one thing I imparted to my students was that if you think about how we as people communicate, how do we learn everything? And the way we learn pretty much anything from anyone else is through dialogue, and it's also through communication of a sort of physical cues and whatnot as well. But dialogue is the way that we really kind of learn about each other. And therefore, I don't understand people who don't see its importance or don't spend a lot of time using it in books, because dialogue is a great way to show your characters who they are, to further the plot, to build tension. It's just, to me, it's one of the main essences of a lot of storytelling, and especially if you're doing sort of longer pieces. They don't necessarily have to be full of dialogue, but I think dialogue is important.
Yeah, definitely. Having said that, there's a lot of very, very bad dialogue out there as well.
Yes, there is.
I was going to say, is dialogue can often be overlaboured. When people start out writing, they try and put everything they can't fit into the narrative into the dialogue, and it doesn't work. Exposition does not belong in your dialogue. So a long description of why someone did something. It's like, well, yesterday I saw Aunt Sally, and of course you know Aunt Sally had three children, and the fourth one actually died, and then obviously two of them grew up, and now I have second cousins, etc., etc., etc. That's all exposition. That doesn't belong in the dialogue.
Yeah.
Also, that's boring. If somebody in real life came up to you and started talking to you like that, I'm assuming that unless you're like some sort of saint, you would shut that conversation down, because I wouldn't stand there and listen to it.
I guess there's also, this is the other thing, which is that there are conversations that we will have in the day-to-day which you don't include in writing, because the problem with dialogue in stories is that it needs to further something. It can't just be filler. It needs to develop something. So either it develops the plot, it develops the characters, it develops the relationships, something along those lines, or it creates a moment of humor. But that's about also about pacing and character, characterization as well. So mundane conversations don't tend to work their way into dialogue. And if you do have mundane conversations in dialogue, it needs to either be for something, or you'll find your readers sort of really turning off. But then there is the opposite of that, where actually people have gone to the realm of dialogue which no one would ever say ever.
Yes.
Really over-exaggerated, over-dramatic, uncharacteristic, and you can get away with that, I think, sometimes in certain fantasy worlds or things along those lines. But when you've got modern day and you've got all the characters speaking in the same, "We shall fight and conquer our enemy, and we shall do it with blinding glory," you start to go, hold on.
Yeah, if it's not a character marker. I mean, this is something that they have trouble with historical novels, actually. Mm-hmm. And I've got no idea whether my story made it or not, but I sent a short story into the anthology that Coates All read. Presumably they'll let me know at some point. But one of the criticisms, I think, that was an issue for certain stories they got, and hopefully not mine because I'm pretty sure I didn't do this, was that in one instance they had people trying to literally write phonetic Cockney for the 18th century, 19th century, for a load of characters. And for one thing, Cockney dialect is so complicated that no linguist has ever managed to render it correctly phonetically. You just can't do it. You can give a flavour of it, but it evolves too quickly.
Yeah.
That's one issue. The other issue is that when you're writing historical novels, really what you need to do to make a character sound like they're from a historical period is not make all their language very forsoothy, but just to rearrange the words very slightly. So instead of saying, "How doth thou likest that," you might say, "How like you that," rather than... Don't add lots of THs and S's and things like that in there, and zounds, because zounds sounds really stupid nowadays. I mean, it was actually like pretty hardcore swearing at the time because it means God's wounds, but now it just sounds really daft. So,
well, you say that, now I'm going to use it in conversation every day.
Zounds.
Zounds.
Okay, if zounds makes a comeback, it's Madeline's fault, everyone. But no, do you see what I mean? You can't. Dialogue is very susceptible to being overwritten, and historical fiction is quite a good place to say this is where it gets overwritten, because people are trying to sound like the historical period. And the reality of the situation is you're never going to completely sound like that, because you're not from that historical time period. You can just capture a flavour of it a little bit by rearranging the words. But if you go too far, you just sound ridiculous.
Interestingly enough, I watched a historical magic realism series called Da Vinci's Demons.
Oh, I heard of that, yeah.
It is quite good. I enjoyed it. It's a little bit silly, but I really, really liked it. And they were speaking in a very modern way, where I think at one point someone even said, "cool." And I was a bit like, "ah." But they did it in such a way that it was almost excusable, because you got the impression that this is not people who are speaking in English. In the original, you know, it was translated, it was transposed. And so I didn't actually so much mind the semi-modern language, because it was used it wasn't over the top kind of, "that's wicked," kind of, "oh my God, I feel so old," kind of thing. It wasn't ridiculous, but I'll accept it, because if people said, "no, it needs to be accurate," then it would have all been, they would have all been speaking Italian.
Yeah.
So I guess having sort of translations of that works quite well. But it does depend how you do it. And I think a problem arises when you try and mix two things that don't really work, where you have a mixture between the highly modern and the very archaic in the same sentence. And unless that's specifically for one character who happens to come from the past and has picked up lingo very quickly and sort of mixes them up, that could be a character trait. But if everyone talks like that, it'll be weird.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. As another example, I don't think anybody really believes that everybody during the sort of 1500s actually spoke like Shakespeare as well.
No.
So obviously that's, again, written in a very particular style, but it would have been much more intelligible at the time, depending on what your view of Shakespeare is. And the same with Chaucer and things like that. But as you say, if you read Shakespeare and you read Chaucer, again, the characters don't all sound the same. And I think this is an issue as well for some writers just in general. So I would say new writers, but I've encountered quite a lot of best-selling writers who somehow manage to make all their characters sound the same, but they've got this addictive quality to the plot for a large group of people, so they manage to sell lots of books. I'm not bitter about this at all, by the way. Your characters will all start out sounding the same because they're all you. They're you wearing lots of different disguises and funny moustaches and hats and things. So your characters are all you. Afterwards, when you first do your first edit, that's when you start making them sound different and making sure you've really got the characterisation in there. And I think some people perhaps just, they just don't do that bit. I don't know, because I don't see how you could get there otherwise.
Yeah, and I think it becomes more natural if you start... If you've just created two sets of characters that you've never written before, and you start to just write with them, in all likelihood, the dialogue will, as Jill said, just sound exactly the same, unless you start out with a very clear idea of who these people are. If you've been writing and editing dialogue between these two characters for a long time, you might be able to get into the swing of writing their kind of writing them accurately from the get-go, but it will still require editing because these things do slip up. You do slip up all the time. And having dialogue which is unique, because no two people talk the same.
No, everybody's got their own little tells and
words
that they're more likely to use, that sort of thing.
Curses that they're more likely to use as well.
Yep.
That's one where every you see something and everyone's using the F word. Everyone is using the F word. And I just think that there will be some people who will go to one swear word quicker than they go to others.
There will be some people who just won't use a word at all, a swear word. It's not even, it would never really occur to them. It's just a case of, for some reason, that one's not in their vernacular, so they don't use it.
Then there's things like that there will be some characters who talk more than others.
Yes. Yeah, to you, the writer, as much as anything else. Okay, I really need to write a bit of narrative now. Can you please shut up?
Yeah.
I was going to say, and then obviously you have to think of the circumstances at the time, because characters will talk differently, either to a greater or lesser extent, if they're upset, if they're finding something funny, if something wonderful's happened, if something awful's happened, if they're grief-stricken. And depending on what their dialogue sort of tells, their vocal tells are, then they might become, you know, they might talk more, they might talk less, they might use words they wouldn't normally use.
Yeah. And then there's the whole added spectrum, which is that it also depends who they're talking to.
Yes. Yeah. I certainly talk differently to different people. Less now, but I certainly wouldn't be quite as free with my speech as I am, say, at the library.
Yeah.
And then there are people who I just probably wouldn't talk about certain subjects with them because I know they have absolutely no interest in it whatsoever. And I know that if I start steering into those sort of subjects, then they tend to start to get this, not bored look, this sort of, oh God, here she is, here's the intellectual snobbery look.
Yeah.
And okay, it's taken me a long time, but I'm clued into that now, so I try not to do it.
Well, I know that I speak differently when I'm, you know, at my grandparents' house. And not just because, and that's my English grandparents. I also speak differently when I'm at my French grandparents' house because I speak in French.
Yes. Unsurprising, really, that.
But that's actually another thing, which is bilinguals. And people do write characters who can speak several different languages. And that's always an interesting thing to do, because bilingual people, you can have so many different sort of, there's a whole spectrum of how bilingual people will communicate. And for some people, it's very much, I'm talking to one person, it's going to be in English, and then I talk to someone else, it's going to be another language. For some people, there'll be certain words. Like, so for me, when I'm talking to you, it doesn't even occur to me to speak to you in French. When I'm talking to my grandmother, it doesn't even occur to me to speak in English. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it's probably just as well, because my French is very rusty.
But it's like a switch. But also when I suddenly, if something shocks me, I might very well just switch to French automatically. But it's one or the other. Then my mother would mostly be a switch, but every now and again in conversations, a French word would come out, or there'd be a pronunciation of an English word, which was definitely French.
Yeah.
Or she'd say something. I knew someone who said, oh yes, we must, could someone open the light? And I was there like, huh. And I had to explain the difference between on and open, which it never occurred to me, but I thought it's actually really logical why she made that mistake, because yeah. it's completely different. And then there are some people who don't even realize which language they're speaking and will switch between them as they're going. I don't know if you've ever been to oh my god, I've just forgotten the name of the place, but basically they speak French, English and Arabic. Lebanon,
yeah,
the Lebanese, they will just switch mid-conversation, mid-sentence into different languages, a bunch of different words. And that's amazing.
I did have, weirdly, I had a conversation like this when my partner's aunt and uncle came up to visit his dad.
Mm-hmm.
This is some time ago. His dad's Romani, and so they speak a lot of, lots of bits of different languages. And I ended up joining in. So, I mean, I don't speak very good Urdu, for a start, but I was certainly joining in with the Gaelic, the Irish and the Welsh. And I wouldn't say I know it so well that I didn't realise there'd been a language switch, but I didn't quite realise what language I'd switched to. and some of what I'm lacking probably is the vocabulary. I'm not properly bilingual. But I'd have to really think to say, I'm going to address you in Irish now, or Gaelic, or whatever. But
yeah,
it was the fact that I was sat there thinking, oh, they've switched languages, but I can still understand what they're saying. It wasn't until I got to Urdu that I was kind of like, I've got no idea what you're saying now. But it was really, really weird. It's not until something like that happens that you sort of realise, actually, I know a bit more than I thought I did.
Yeah. And that can be reflected in dialogue. You have to think, if you have a bilingual character, what level of bilingual are they? What kind of bilingual? Are they the switch? Are they the kind of the occasional slip up? Which is the stronger language? Are they both even? You know, one question I ask, and this is a good thing to ask yourself when thinking about how to write a bilingual character, is I knew someone who was bilingual, and one day his wife turned to him and just said, when you go to the cash points when we're abroad, do you select English or French? And he went, I don't know.
You wouldn't necessarily, would you? I've done it before where I've clicked the German button and only realised it afterwards.
Yeah, and he just genuinely just couldn't remember which language he chose, because all he knew is he understood it. So ask yourself, if my character was going to a cash point, which language would they select? And also, bear in mind that bilingual people, if you're in the country, you're more likely to start to kind of tip towards it. So when I'm in France, I end up dreaming in French. And when I'm in England, I mostly dream in English.
You know, I'd never realised it before, but I do sometimes dream in Gaelic.
That's very cool.
You say it's cool. It's no more exotic than French.
I know, but I started to dream in Japanese, actually, on my holiday. That was when I started to feel a bit more confident about my Japanese. I was like, yes, I'm now at a level where I can have comprehensive dreams in Japanese.
See, now you've said that, that's made me think that all your dreams were like anime.
They might have been.
When there were giant robots and lots of flying and stuff. Explosions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, right, getting back on to dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, as I've just said, characters will talk differently depending on the situation. I'm going to illustrate this point now with the exercise that Madeline and I did earlier.
Oh God, okay, all right.
Now, what I asked Madeline to do was write, to give credit, this was an exercise I did when I met up with a whole bunch of people from the Writers' Workshop at the Eagle and Child, which is where Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and various others, the Inklings, used to meet up. Anyway, what I asked her to do was write two characters, completely in dialogue, character A, character B, and just keep swapping it back and forth and to limit herself to 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I did the same thing. Now, A or B?
B.
Right. Madeline is going to read character B. Character B reads second. So, you're going to ignore all your character A lines.
Jesus Christ.
Okay. I'm going to read my character A, which means character A reads first. So I will read my line first.
Oh my God, okay.
So I read character A, Madeline reads her character B. We're going to have an argument for you.
All right.
That's the whole point of this. It is actually, in fact, an argument.
Okay.
So bear with me just a moment. Just get the giggles out your system now.
This is going to be great.
Obviously, it'll be gradually escalating emotion. Try and sound a little bit annoyed.
All right.
And if we end up interrupting each other, just go on to the next line and we'll go from there. I mean, this isn't a performance art piece. This is just to illustrate a point.
Okay.
Okay. Right. Ready?
Yeah.
I told you that in confidence.
Dick, hi.
That's not the point. You shouldn't. It was private.
Nice to see you too. Yeah, I've been doing great. Thanks.
Use private information. Why can't I make you see how dangerous this is?
Okay, you need to take a step back.
Why do you always underestimate me?
Let go.
I'm not, but no one is.
Let go of me, or I'll knock your teeth out with a hammer.
You're making a big deal out of it when you don't need to. This is what you do, right? Well, now I'm helping.
I'm sorry, I'm not following you here.
I can handle it. I can look after myself. I'm sick of you putting me in only to push me away again. Do you know what that's like?
I don't have to listen to this. I really, really don't have to listen to this.
It feels like shit, that's what. I'm always behind you and you're always half-hearted about me.
What?
I can't talk to you like this.
I'm done.
Now, assuming anyone listens to that, that's going to probably make very little logical sense, but that's the point about an argument. When you get people who are het up, they're not listening to what each other's saying. You can insert anything you like. That was pretty tame. I think in Oxford, I had something about a balloon giraffe, and Shell, who was reading her bit with me, had something about someone leaving and going to be an actress. And you know, again, it made no sense, but reading it together, it was funny, but it was also a case of, it does illustrate the point that when you've got two people arguing, what one person is saying is not what the other person's hearing, and vice versa. So as a little dialogue exercise, that's always a good fun one to do.
Right, do you want to swap round? I'll do A, you do B.
Okay.
All right. Ready?
Yeah.
What did you do with it?
I didn't think you'd mind. Anyway, I got the ball rolling again.
What did you do with it?
It's really not the point. It's no big deal.
This isn't funny! What the hell did you do with it?
I just didn't. I mean, look, everything's going to be fine.
Tell me where it is.
Well, I can't because, look, you're upset right now and I think you should just, like, maybe sit down.
I swear to God, if you don't tell me...
I need you to make up your mind. And I really think I should be somewhere else right now.
Tell me where it is. What did you do with it?
This isn't an... Look, I don't want to talk to you when you're like this.
The stone. Where did you put it?
And I'm out.
Ugh.
So, I mean, I was a bit mean because I didn't explain to Madeline in advance what we were doing this for.
Yeah, I had no idea.
She just blithely went along with me. So, round of applause for that.
That was great.
But, you know, if you've got a writing buddy, then have a go at this. You can do it via Messenger or whatever, as long as you're relatively facile. Or do it via Skype.
Yeah. Also be aware that a character might not always know what they're trying to say either.
No, this is true.
They might just be angry and say stuff and then be like, I don't actually know what I want. I don't really know what I'm arguing about. I'm just really angry.
I've just written a scene in I Rule the Night where I've got two characters arguing and they're both thinking something different is going on to what is actually happening.
Oh, Christ, Jules.
And it's very funny, but it's also, I'm sort of writing it, I'm ripping my own heart out as I'm doing it.
You're a terrible human being.
But that's the exercise I was thinking about, because obviously both of them had made assumptions and they're so wound up that they can't hear what the other person is saying. So obviously not all dialogue is about arguing, but all dialogue is about sort of some form of negotiation, really. So what one person is saying and meaning is not necessarily what the other person's hearing, and that's something to bear in mind when you write dialogue.
Yeah. There's also something else to bear in mind, which is that we decide what we say some of the time. Sometimes words just come out of us and we have very little control. But other times, we actively and carefully choose the things that we say. But what someone says might not actually be true, even if they themselves believe it to be true. So for instance, when I write a lot of Zachary, he sees himself as a villain, he sees himself as someone who's horrible and awful, and so he often says really nasty things. And these nasty things are very contrasted by what he actually does. So, for instance, one scene in The Sons of Festian, he's just been out. He led a child ride on his horse. He's just plaited a little crown, a little garland of flowers, and carefully put it on his housekeeper's head to symbolise that he sees her as his mother and, you know, that he's grateful for all that she's done. And having done all that, he says, right, don't wake me up until it's time for me to kill someone.
Yeah.
But he's there thinking, oh, there I am, you know, I'm tough. But it's totally contrasted by who he actually is. And a way to show that is to contrast deed and dialogue, and also to reflect how people behave around him based on the dialogue that he says. Do they roll their eyes? Do they go, yeah, 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 whatever? Do they act in fear? Do they believe him? Consider these things, because someone's reaction to dialogue could be as much a tell about what they're really saying as it could be them just saying it.
Yeah, definitely. That's where you look at things like, you would look at things like speech tags, and so you want to be fairly moderate with speech tags, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And with the beats around it, sometimes you don't need to use said or expostulated. If you use expostulated, you're writing in the wrong century, by the way. But you might use something like, as you say, he rolled his eyes or she shrugged.
Yeah.
He grinned wickedly, kind of thing. Which, again, gives you a little bit more information than you can put in the actual line of dialogue itself.
Yeah.
I mean, the main thing with dialogue is it should be sharp. It should be crisp. It shouldn't read like description.
No, it shouldn't. But think about how we speak. How do we speak?
Depends who... We're back to it. It depends who I'm speaking to. I'm probably a bit more descriptive than I think I am. I'm also probably a lot blunter than I think I am, which is not good.
I stutter more and blather a lot. I think that's all I can say. And I repeat words a great deal. Good for repeating myself.
I think another point is, with dialogue, less is often more, because often it's the things that aren't said that are really important. So if we go back to the whole argument scene, it's the things that weren't being said there. There was two people who were too angry to have a proper conversation. So they weren't saying what was really upsetting them. They weren't being straight and sitting down and talking like adults. They were too busy trying to let off steam or score points off each other.
Yeah.
So all the things that weren't being said there is the stuff that's really important. You can have the same thing in any situation. You can have two people who've just had sex having a conversation, and they're not talking about sex. Well, they might be on the surface, but what they're really talking about is something completely different.
Yeah. We speak in metaphors, even when we're not sure that we're speaking in metaphors. So yeah, dialogue is probably doesn't get enough attention, I think, actually, in the editing.
Yeah, that certainly can be the case. Now, having said that me having said, sorry, me having said the whole more is less is more kind of thing, occasionally well, put it this way, if you do your dialogue right and you've got a character who just speaks about the average amount, isn't too mouthy, and is really quite short and doesn't speak too much, later on that can earn you a really, really big blow up from the character where they just literally go on for about a page and it's earned, it's not out of place.
Yeah.
A good thing to do if you want to practice dialogue, obviously, is to read a few screenplays and see how that works as well. With screenplays and plays and various other things, try and read them aloud. So maybe not on the train. It's up to you. How do you feel about funny looks? People might think you're busking. But okay, a really good example. This is a good example, and it's quite long, so you're going to have to bear with me.
Okay.
Have you seen Good Will Hunting?
No. Yes, I have. Sorry.
For the people who haven't seen it, it's a lad from the wrong side of the tracks who just happens to be a mathematical genius, as in it's easy for him. He says it himself. He looks at it. He knows how to do it. And he's really, really, really intelligent. But he's come from an abusive home life and he's got a massive chip on his shoulder about it. And he swears a lot. He's really quite unpleasant in his speech. In general, he gives everybody the brush off. Then they realise how good he is at maths, and the NSA are trying to get hold of him for a job. And this is what he's saying to his therapist. So this is the famous monologue from Good Will Hunting.
Okay.
Why shouldn't I work for the NSA? That's a tough one, but I'll take a shot. Say I'm working at the NSA. Somebody puts a code on my desk, something no one else can break. Maybe I take a shot at it and maybe I break it. And I'm real happy with myself, because I did my job well. But maybe that code was the location of some rebel army in North Africa or the Middle East. Once they have that location, they bomb the village where the rebels were hiding, and 1,500 people I never met, never had no problem with, get killed. Now the politicians are saying, I'll send in the Marines to secure the area, because they don't give a shit. It won't be their kid over there getting shot. Just like it wasn't them when their number got called because they were pulling a tour in the National Guard. It'll be some kid from Southie taking shrapnel in the ass. Then he comes back to find that plant he used to work at got exported to the country he just got back from, and the guy who put the shrapnel in his ass got his old job. Because he'll work for 15 cents a day and no bathroom breaks. Meanwhile, he realises the only reason he was over there in the first place was so he could install a government that would sell us oil at a good price. And of course, the oil companies use the skirmish over there to scare up domestic oil prices. A cute little ancillary benefit for them, but it ain't helping my buddy at $2.50 a gallon. And they're taking their sweet time bringing the oil back. And of course, maybe even took the liberty of hiring an alcoholic skipper who likes to drink martinis and fucking play slalom with the icebergs. And it ain't too long till he hits one, spills the oil, and kills all the sea life in the North Atlantic. So, now my buddy's out of work and he can't afford to drive. So he's got to walk to the fucking job interviews, which sucks because the shrapnel in his ass is giving him chronic hemorrhoids. And meanwhile, he's starving because every time he tries to get a bite to eat, the only blue plate special they're serving is North Atlantic scrod with Quaker State. So what did I think? I'm holding out for something better. I figure, fuck it, while I'm at it, why not just shoot my buddy, take his job, give it to his sworn enemy, hike up gas prices, bomb a village, club a baby seal, hit the hash pipe, and join the National Guard. I could be elected president.
That's incredible.
Now, I'm not Matt Damon, I'm not a talented actor of any stripe, but all the way through that film, he's kind of like quite self-contained, and then someone finally says, well, you know, you've been offered this dream job, why haven't you taken it? It's like, because in the 30 seconds it took my brain to process it and the words to get to my mouth, that's what I computed. And it's really, really amazing screenwriting to do that. And it's earned because he's so self-contained and says very little really comparatively before that.
Yeah. I think another one of the very highly emotive scenes in Good Will Hunting is, I'm pretty sure this is Good Will Hunting, yeah, where quite near the end, he and his therapist, or he and one of the teachers, discuss the abuse that he received at home. And this is an incredibly emotive scene because it actually involves very, very few words, which are repeated.
Yeah.
And it is Robin Williams, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and he basically says it wasn't your fault. And it's very simple. There's no kind of big kind of emotional talk. He doesn't give him a long speech. It actually sort of comes up quite abruptly, and he just says it wasn't your fault. And Matt Damon's character goes, yeah, I know. And then he keeps repeating it. And yeah, there's this breakdown, which happens with very, very few, very simple words. And I think that sometimes when writing emotive scenes, we get caught up in the grandeur of big statements. And it's the little statements, actually, the simplicity, the quiet, that sometimes is the most heartbreaking. Again, think of the very memorable line from Star Wars. Han Solo's about to be frozen. I love you. I know. That stuck with us.
Yeah.
In the same way, that very simple line, we're going to need a bigger boat. And I'll have what she's having. These are very short, very simple lines which have hit the nail on the head and have stayed with us. So sometimes don't be too caught up in trying to write something dramatic, because the most dramatic thing you can do is write something simple.
Yeah, it's how the dialogue is used. And obviously that scene from Good Will Hunting is an excellent example. Mm-hmm. Another good one is Fight Club.
And yes.
They've literally lifted the word straight off the page by, I can't remember the author now, Chuck somebody. Anyway, it'll come back to me. But the dialogue in that is very sharp as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing. One thing I would say is you have to be a bit careful in the sense of, if you're writing a book, there is a slight difference to writing a book and a screenplay. Your dialogue should be really good, but you shouldn't just be filling your book with sound bites.
Yeah.
Which is what, unfortunately, Victoria Aveyard did with The Red Queen. It got so much promotion, and then when you actually read the book, it's this confused mishmash of about six other things that were already popular. And it's very noticeable that each book since then has gone down a little bit in popularity. And I think part of the problem there was the dialogue. It's not realistic. All the characters sound like each other. And each character is not saying what... is not showing what sort of person they are. They're not advancing the plot. They're all just coming out with sound bites.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. And it does actually happen sometimes where it just feels like... these are not characters, you've just come up with lines that you wanted to put in. And so they say things which feel very out of place, but are just, yeah, they're literally there so that you could tick that box and say, yeah, I included that joke, or yeah, I included that in it. And conversation does have a natural flow, even if sometimes random things can happen in conversation, new topics can start out of the blue. There is usually a natural flow to how we do things. And how we communicate.
Yeah, definitely. And dialogue should tell you, when the character is speaking, it should tell you a little bit about what that character's like, possibly where they're from, depending on, you know, how they speak, how they arrange words.
Mm-hmm.
And it should tell you what the next bit of plot is.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's so simple, it's difficult, but that's the sort of thing dialogue should be telling you.
Yeah. Yeah, completely with you on that.
And I say this in the full and certain knowledge that I have not got dialogue completely cracked yet either.
Well, no, I think that dialogue is something that we'll really be working on, just in the same way that writing is something that we will just continue to have to work on forever, to be honest.
Yeah, there's no end point.
No, there's no moment where you go, yeah, that's it, I've cracked it. I think out of all of the writing, I'm quite strong with dialogue. Stronger than with dialogue, perhaps, than I am with other aspects of writing. But even I know that it doesn't end here. You continue to improve, you continue to work, you continue to progress. So what are some books that you've read which have excellent examples of dialogue?
Excellent examples. Generally, they'd have to be really quite exceptional for me to say, yeah, the dialogue leapt off the page. I'm trying to think, particularly speculative fiction-wise.
I think that Terry Pratchett was very good with dialogue.
Yes, actually. I mean, generally, he was very good with words, full stop.
Yeah.
Sickeningly.
But his dialogue, each character did feel very individual. I at no point ever thought, oh, this is just another, it's the same character with a different face.
Yeah. I think with dialogue with me, a lot of it is a case, you know, there's ones where I think this isn't too bad, but what's very noticeable is that people write young adult fiction. Obviously, I read quite a lot of it because it's in my wheelhouse,
mm-hmm.
and they try to make the characters sound like young adults, and that's, you know, that's a dynamic that's continually evolving. It's impossible to make your characters sound like, well, no, it's not impossible to make your character sound like young adults. It's impossible to do something that that'll hit at the moment, because it's already moved on by the time you get there. It's like programming the next computer. You're just not going to get it. But one person who did very well was Joss Whedon, and he wrote something that sounded like it could be said by teens and 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
So with, say, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, that's a really good example. Nobody really talks like that, but at the same time, it would be easy to think of people of that age group talking in that way. So perhaps that's the golden mean, that's what you aim for. You don't try and make it sound exactly like you'd hear teens speaking today, because tomorrow they won't be speaking that way.
Exactly. And the thing is, yeah, you could have it absolutely right, but then the book will age very noticeably.
Yes.
And that's actually something interesting that Joss Whedon did with Firefly.
Yeah.
Because he had to write the slang of the future.
Which was very interesting when you translated
it. Yeah, but I thought it was great the way he did, because you could see the progression of how that slang would have happened, of how it would have occurred. This Asian meld between English and sort of, I think it was mostly Chinese. Was it Mandarin? Or was it says, Mandarin. I'm sure there was maybe some Cantonese in there as well. I don't know. It was, yeah, there was this nice kind of, it was just a hot pot of stuff, of languages.
Yeah.
And you could absolutely believe that this was slang. It didn't feel forced at all.
No.
And that was partly down to the performances, but...
Yeah, that's true. Slang's quite difficult anyway. I felt relatively confident using a certain amount of Irish slang for, say, Kieran's chants, because I've known that my cousins and things, and even myself, talk that way, and have done for at least 20-odd years. And, you know, there are phrases that go in and out of fashion, but there are some that really just, that they're still there.
Stay, yeah.
But I would feel less sure about writing, I suppose, a more Cockney dialect, or, you know, if I wanted to write, I've got no idea about, say, French slang, for example.
It's French slang that we were taught in school, the word hyper. Hyper means hyper, but as in, you'd say something was hyper cool, hyper cool. And I thought, no one possibly in France can say that. No one can speak like that. But I have heard my cousins use it. Genuinely, they go, oh, c'est hyper bien, hyper cool. And I'm just there like, no, you sound like you're from the 70s. But apparently, it's just, I guess, because of the association in England. That's hyper cool. But they do. And I don't know whether maybe it's because my cousins are really old-fashioned or not. I have no idea.
It's like over here we wouldn't say rad or gnarly in the same way anymore.
I got told off for using the word neat.
Neat. Why not?
I was just told that someone said that's like you saying that's so wizard. And I'm like, I've never heard that saying before in my life.
I have to say, if there's anything where someone goes, you sound like you're from, like, 6 decades ago, I just say, I'm bringing it back again. The trouble is, sometimes I sound like I'm from 200 years ago, and I'm just like, well, I like it, so I'm bringing it back. I stubbornly ignore the fact that no one understands what I just said, and I'm not communicating well. I'm just going to say what I like.
I tend to find that when in doubt, communicating grunts. People understand grunts. Though, oddly enough, grunts work differently wherever you are. Now this is a fun thing, because you obviously get hand signals and kind of sort of certain noises. But for instance, if we're speaking now and I go then you know that means no, or, and if I go then that's yes.
Yeah.
My mother could not get it. When my brother and I used to do it, we'd be like and she'd be like, "What does that mean, yes?" And we're like, no, it means no. But then in Japan, if you go, that means yes. So there's a confusion there. But yeah. It's very, very odd. The other thing is the and no French conversation and no French radio would be complete without the long which accompanies the majority of French conversations.
Do you know how long it took me to work out that that wasn't a real word?
Yeah, it's just...
It was so frustrating.
It's just this drone.
It's just like, what are they saying?
That,
they don't
that's
teach
what.
you this in a French class.
No, they don't. They don't teach you in French class. And that's another thing. When writing dialogue, especially writing dialogue for certain areas, and certain cultures, the best thing you can do is probably watch TV or listen to some radio. Radio is very good because it will be, or podcasts, because it won't be scripted necessarily. So you can hear real kind of speech patterns. So French radio sounds very much like this. Et bon, mais non, on est allé. C'est bien passé. C'est tout on pouvait faire. It's like they can't have silence between any of the words. You've got to keep that groan going.
I do remember when, okay, admittedly, this is some time ago. I do remember when I was over doing the German exchange. I was over in Ravensburg, and we were trying to find an equivalent word for cool because we were saying something was cool, and they didn't have cool. They used the word guile, and then instead, a friend of mine was trying to say "I am cool," but in German, so she said "Ich bin geil," and all the Germans absolutely pissed themselves laughing because geil means horny. Well, they're saying that something is horny because, that's their word for cool. But if you were to say I am, then you're saying I am horny. And so she was wandering around Ravensburg saying Ich bin geil. So, you can't just keep going up to people saying you're horny. Bad stuff happens.
Yes.
So, once again, the cross-country divide there.
The other thing to consider is cultural sayings
And mannerisms.
and mannerisms, and practices of certain things. So, for instance, going back to the Japanese, they will say tadaima when they get home. And sometimes when we get in, we go, I'm home, but it's not quite the same. And when they're leaving, they say itadakimasu. And trying to translate that, it can feel quite unnatural because we don't really have the same kind of habit in England. We don't,
Yeah.
again, we might say I'm off, but it's not, it isn't quite the same.
Yeah, absolutely. What Alan, my other half, found when he used to do a lot of work out in India was that the Indians do not like to give you a negative answer. They don't like to say no, particularly if you're in charge. So they'll agree. You'll say this not in it. This is a cultural thing because if we over here in Britain say something's going to be done by such and such a date, we expect people to say no if they're not going to get it done by that date. Ideally, we expect them to say no. The Indians don't do that. The Indians say, "Oh yes, sir, they'll be done by," etc. And then they'll add a little head waggle from side to side. So not a shake, but literally they're shaking their head from side to side. And it took Alan a while to work out that depending on how they shook their head, they were either saying, "Yes, it'll definitely be done," but the head waggle's telling him, "No, it's not going to be done, not on your life," kind of thing. But
Yeah,
they
but it's absolutely it's certain body behaviors. It's gestures as well, which is that the equivalent of that you get in Arabic countries is inshallah. So they'll say, "Yes, it'll happen, inshallah." Inshallah means if God wills it,
Yes.
which I think is a great phrase because it could just be it's like we will absolutely be there on time, inshallah.
Well, it's like in Irish slang, you'll say, "I will ya," and what you're actually saying is, "Yeah, in a pig's eye, that would be done." But it actually sounds like you're saying, "Yeah, totally."
Exactly. It happens across all sorts of cultures, but we sort of treat it, we treat it differently, but it's great. And the other one was that my mother, because she obviously she spent more time in English speaking sort of cultures, sort of around our family speaking English than she ever did in France, she started to translate things from English into French, so sayings which don't actually make any sense in French at all. But then she'd also do that the other way around. So she'd have French sayings and she'd translate them into English. And of course, I grew up with them, so I'd be like, yeah, that's normal. And then I say them at school and people are like, we have no idea what you're saying. That doesn't make any sense at all. But one of my favorites, and I'm probably saying this wrong, I think it's blackbird. She used to say, you couldn't find a blackbird and a glass of milk. And it's either a blackbird or it's a crow or something like that. But I thought that that was one of the best French sayings I've ever heard of.
I have to admit, I've got no idea what that means.
It just means someone, it's someone who is incapable. You know when you open a cupboard and you're like, you really can't find the thing you're looking for at all, and it's right in front of you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't see for looking.
Yeah, it is that you're just so bad at finding stuff. You wouldn't be able to find a blackbird in a glass of milk.
I'd probably prefer couldn't find your ass with both hands.
So yeah, lots of things to consider when writing dialogue.
Yes,
and building characters.
And if anyone has a go at that exercise, let us know how you get on.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from it. Well, I think we've run out of time.
We have. So we'll just say thanks and goodbye.
Thanks for listening. Catch you guys next week.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.